Hello and welcome to this podcast looking at self-harm and suicide prevention in older adults. I'm Liz England, I'm the RCGP Mental Health Lead and Older Adult Mental Health Fellow, which is a post funded by NHS England. I'm also a GP and Commissioner for Mental Health Services. I'm joined today by Carolyn Chew Graham, who is a GP in Manchester, Professor of General Practice Research, and RCGP Curriculum Advisor and Chair of the RCGP Scientific Foundation Board. We want to raise awareness of suicide and self-harm in older adults to mark World Suicide Prevention Day. And so we hope by the end of this podcast that the listener will understand prevalence, risk factors, and importance of self-harm in older people, the key features of self-harm and suicide in older adults, prevalence and impact of mental health problems, and we're going to particularly look and discuss depression in the older adult population and the relationship between self-harm and depression, and then be able to actually use this learning practically for our patient population, their families and caregivers. So we'll start by Carolyn. Could you explain why are self-harm and suicide important in older people?
Okay, well, first of all, suicide is amongst the top 20 leading causes of death globally for people of all ages. But data reported from the Office of National Statistics, the ONS, in England and Wales, indicate that suicide rates in older women and older men are increasing. So that the key point to remember is that suicide is not just a problem of younger people.
Okay, so from that then, can I ask why self-harm is important in relationship to suicide prevention?
Yes, self-harm is important because it's the strongest risk factor for suicide. There is a difference between younger adults and older adults in that older people who have self-harm behaviour have an increased risk of suicide in the future. Although repetition rates are low, self-harm is more often fatal in older adults.
Okay, so you have co-authored a number of papers looking at self-harm and suicide in the older adult population. So can you just summarize why self-harm is important in older adults?
So we all know of a demographic shift. There's an increasing number of older people in the population. Older people may not want to seek help for low mood or for thoughts of self-harm and suicide. And we know that fewer than one in six older adults who have depressive symptoms ever discuss it with a GP. Most older adults don't recognize that their feelings represent low mood and represent depression, which could be treated. Or if they do recognize it, they don't want to go and access care. We also know that older people who do access care, do go and perhaps see a GP, their low mood may not be recognised, certainly may be undertreated, they may not be referred to psychological services, and unfortunately older adults are more likely to be on antidepressants for a longer time rather than being referred to psychological services or to specialist mental health services.
Okay, that's really interesting. So there's some real differences then, sort of from how self-harm and depression seem to present in younger people. Could we just have a talk about your recent paper that you published on self-harm? This was in the British Journal of Psychiatry. Can you describe this paper to us and some of the findings?
Yeah, so I'm not going to take credit for this paper. This systematic review was led by one of my PhD students, Isabella Troyer. And we provide an up-to-date review of the evidence published about self-harm in older adults. And we managed to find 40 studies to include in the review. And we describe the rates, risk factors, clinical characteristics, but also the lived experience of older adults with self-harm behaviour. So the prevalence rates of self-harm that were reported vary between 19 and 65 per 100,000 older adults. And the majority of the presentations were self-poisoning. And that's really important when older adults are often on a number of medications, some of which can be toxic in overdose. Less common methods that were reported in this review included cutting and burning. We also found that certain clinical characteristics were important. So older adults who got comorbid long-term physical conditions were more at risk of self-harm. And risk of repetition of self-harm was obviously associated with previous self-harm, but also previous and current psychiatric treatment. I've already mentioned that prescribed medication was important, and in the review, more than half the people were prescribed antidepressants following a self-harm episode. In addition, alcohol misuse was picked up as being important. So we concluded that self-harm in older adults has got distinct characteristics that are really important for primary care to understand. We reported that risk of suicide is higher in older adults, and we thought that given the frequent contact with health services, there's an opportunity for primary care particularly to detect and prevent and manage people appropriately following self-harm. And hopefully that will lead to a reduction in self-harm repetition and a reduction in suicide.
Sounds to me as a GP that there's really an opportunity there, sort of in routine day-to-day practice, to think a bit more about this topic and try and, you know, think about some of the things you said as risk factors and other areas. I think you looked at the epidemiology of self-harm in older adults, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this was a different study working with a team in the Patient Safety Translational Research Centre in Manchester, and we looked at data in the UK Clinical Practice Data Link. This is a data set which contains anonymised patient records from general practice, but also captures information from secondary care service. Here we found the incidence of self-harm to be 4.1 per 100,000 person, for 10,000 person years. We found, as with the systematic review, that self-harm was more common when there's been a previous diagnosis of mental illness and with long-term physical conditions. And again, self-harm was shown to be a risk factor for suicide. What this study showed was that only about 11 to 12% of older adults following a self-harm episode were referred to mental health services. So most are managed in primary care, and that's a key message for GPs. Almost 60%, however, of the people who were included in our study were actually prescribed an antidepressant, and what was really worrying was that nearly 12% was prescribed a tricyclic antidepressant, and that's toxic in overdose. So there seems to be the prescription of tricyclics to people who are at risk of self-harm through self-poisoning. So that's a really key message, again, for GPs to be aware of prescribing following self-harm.
Okay, thank you. And do you know whether old people present in the same way as younger people? Could you summarise if there's any similarities or differences in how people present with self-harm?
So there's not a great deal of other evidence apart from what I've presented from Isabella's study. But it does seem that older adults will have poorer physical health, will have had previous episodes of self-harm, are more likely to report physical health as a stressor. So people get stressed and distressed when they've got long-term conditions, and that does put them at increased risk of self-harm and suicide. And again, the key message is that older adults who have exhibited self-harm behaviour are more at risk of dying through suicide. And therefore, it's vital that self-harm is appropriately managed in older adults.
And you sort of mentioned that suicide is more common in people with mental health problems. Is that, you mentioned depression, any other mental health problems?
So mental health problems in older adults, commonly anxiety and depression, but alcohol misuse, which I've already mentioned, anxiety disorder, delirium, and late onset schizophrenia. So these are all key diagnoses, key conditions that need to be considered when we're faced with a person who has self-harm behavior. But we know that depression is one of the most common mental health problems in older adults, and it's the most common that's associated with self-harm behavior, and it's seen and managed in primary care.
it's much more common, if depression is more common in older adults, and it's associated with self-harm and suicide, how does it actually present?
So depression can present in exactly the same way as in younger adults, with core symptoms such as low mood, lack of energy, reduced enjoyment in things, or psychological symptoms, feelings of hopelessness and guilt, or the biological symptoms, and that's particularly common in older adults, the reduced appetite, weight loss, early morning wakening, poor sleep. But actually, older adults may not present with these symptoms. They may emphasize the physical symptoms, so they may complain of fatigue or pain, weakness all over. And a clue that I've always thought is useful, when an older adult sits down and says, "Can I have a tonic, doctor?" That to me is an indication that I need to explore their mood. We also know that some older adults can present without any affective component at all, so they don't complain of feelings of low mood or sadness. They can complain of feeling flat or complete lack of emotion. So again, that's something for GPs to be aware of in their consultations with older adults.
So it sounds quite a difficult process. Ways that we could be slightly more alert to depression in older people. Could you think of any ways that might work?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of evidence that older adults are reluctant to talk about their depression, and that even if they present, they may find that the healthcare practitioner normalizes their symptoms. So the key is to have a conversation with a person and really to try and explore their problems, particularly when there's loss or bereavement or comorbid physical symptoms. Observing body language is really important, and giving the person time, recognizing what's going on for that person at that point in time. But time, I think, is one of the biggest barriers to this in general practice. We have a 10-minute consultation, and it may be that more than one consultation is required to enable the GP to really get to the bottom of what the patient's concerns are and to see whether there's an underlying diagnosis of depression in this person who's consulting.
So thank you for that. And I'm just thinking, given that time is a barrier, is there any way we could maximize our approach and our thinking towards this? Could we use a case finding approach, targeting approach?
Absolutely. There's quite a bit of evidence that there are certain groups of people who are more at risk of depression, and particularly these are people with long-term physical health conditions. So these reviews are often conducted by practice nurses, and we know that the case planning questions were introduced into the quality and outcome framework for people with heart disease and diabetes, and then they disappeared from the quality and outcomes framework. Partly, I think, because practice nurses may not feel comfortable inquiring about mood, and so there was a reluctance to use them.
So interesting. Okay. So could you just remind me, what are the case finding questions?
Yeah. So the NICE Clinical Guideline 91, which is the guideline around depression in adults with a chronic physical health problem, suggests that we should be using these case finding questions. And it's worthwhile printing them out and sort of putting them near your computer for patients that you think might have a depressive illness. So, over the past 2 weeks, have you been bothered by having little interest or pleasure in doing things? And over the past 2 weeks, have you often been bothered by feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? So I tend to ask them in people who've got long-term physical conditions, people consulting for medication reviews, people who've been recently bereaved, and older adults with a past history of mental health problems.
That's great. So if we're suspecting that there could be depression, if we get our case finding questions and there's a possibility, what would we then do? What's the best practice in making a diagnosis of depression in primary care?
Okay, so I think for older adults, it's much more complicated and complex than for younger adults. So we need to inquire about alcohol and drugs, identifying risk of self-harm and suicide ideation. We might want to assess severity of depression with a PHQ-9, and that can be helpful to share the score with the person. Obviously, you'd want to do that in a younger adult, but with an older adult, it's really important to think about basic blood tests, because actually, does this mood problem represent hypothyroidism or anemia or chronic renal failure? So those basic blood tests are key. What's also important, as I've said, is to ask about feelings of hopelessness, any thoughts that they wish they were dead, whether there's been any self-harm behavior. And assessing risk is a key part of the assessment. So does the person have a plan to kill themselves? Have they thought about when, where, how they might do this? Have they put any measures in place to prevent them being found? But importantly, are there any protective factors? So an older adult may express thoughts of self-harm or suicide, but actually may say, I would never do it because of my dog, or because I'm Catholic, or because of my family, I wouldn't want to hurt people. So exploring those protective factors is a key part of risk assessment. It's then really important to agree a plan with the person to make sure that they're safe. Do they need referring at that point to the crisis team or a home treatment team? Or actually, can you see that person in a few days' time to carry on with a plan and manage them in primary care?
And can you recommend any way? Sometimes I think people feel a bit uncomfortable asking about suicidal ideas and self-harm. Is there any recommendations that you can make when asking about risk?
Okay, so I think there are two approaches, and sometimes clinicians adopt one approach. Sometimes clinicians can be flexible and decide on the day what approach to use for the particular patient. So you can use a direct approach or normalizing approach. And for the direct approach, there are questions like, do you feel like harming yourself? Do you feel like getting away from it all? Do you mean that you want to kill yourself? Have you been thinking of killing yourself? Do you ever feel that you want to be dead and away from it all? So very direct approaches. Sometimes, in some situations, that might not be appropriate for the person in front of you. And so a normalizing approach can be much softer. So sometimes when people are feeling distressed, they think of harming themselves. Is this something you've been thinking of? And that maybe gives the person permission to disclose it, whereas the direct questions might not be met so effectively.
So really, it's sort of patient-focused, depending on the patient themselves.
Yeah.
So if we've got to the point where we've made a diagnosis and we've done our risk assessment, is the treatment exactly the same as for younger people? Is there any evidence that one thing is better than another in older adults with depression?
So just thinking about the treatment for people with depression in general and the NICE guideline, the role that the GP plays is really key. So giving advice about sleep, about alcohol, about exercise and activity, about social engagement. And really important is to offer follow-up. So don't just make the diagnosis and give advice, but also arrange to see that person in a week or 2 weeks. We know that talking effectives are as effective in older adults as in younger people. So we should think about referring a person to the improving psychological services. Yet we know that older adults are not referred at the same rate as younger adults. We also know that older adults may not find the IAPT, the Improving Access to Psychological Therapy Services, as acceptable as younger adults do. I think GPs have a potential to consider using the principles of behavioral activation within their consultation. So encouraging the older adults to resume activities that they might have stopped as a result of low mood. Or thinking about planning new activities which the patient will find pleasurable and therefore elevate their mood. IAPT could offer counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, problem solving therapy, all of which are evidence-based and evidence-based for older adults. I think there's also an increasing emphasis on social prescribing, quite a lot of investment in social prescribing. I think that's probably less stigmatizing for older adults, more acceptable to them. And therefore, as GPs, we should be aware of what's available in our area. We have a link worker. Think about, do we refer this older adult to the link worker to link in with some of the local groups like Men in Sheds or Knit and Chat or Poetry Corner. There's a myriad of different activities.
So that's again another practical thing that we can think about, sort of having a list of organisations or at least a way of linking the person.
And posting, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What about drugs though and medication? So, you know, do they have a place? You mentioned that lots of people seem to be on medication in your study. Should we be prescribing drugs?
So antidepressants are effective for people with moderate to severe depression, and that's younger and older adults alike. And the principles of prescribing antidepressants for older adults are the same as prescribing in younger adults. So the NICE guidance suggests first-line treatment with an SSRI, that's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And the antidepressant should be guided by the patient's previous experience of an antidepressant and by their comorbidities and their drugs. Really, tricyclic antidepressants shouldn't be initiated in primary care for depression. They are sometimes suggested by specialist care for treatment-resistant depression, that is, depression that hasn't responded to an antidepressant, such as an SSRI. However, the evidence for this addition of a tricyclic antidepressant is actually limited. We know that GPs frequently start amitriptyline, for example, for chronic pain in older adults. Again, the evidence for that is limited, and really we should be avoiding the co-prescribing of a tricyclic and an SSRI because of the risk of side effects, interactions, but also the risk of overdose. So just a reminder that tricyclics are toxic in overdose. Older adults who are depressed, who have thoughts of self-harm or have a history of self-harm behavior, are at risk of repetition and are at risk of using the drugs that we prescribe to them to overdose.
How long should we be prescribing antidepressants for? Is it the same again as younger people?
Yep, so again, you'd expect to try an antidepressant for at least 4 weeks before you make a change. And you'd make sure that you were, as a GP, monitoring that person, not just send them on their way with a prescription. Really, it's important to monitor because older adults have side effects from antidepressants much more than younger adults do, so particularly gastrointestinal disorders, agitation, hyponatremia. NICE guidance suggests that we should continue antidepressants for at least 6 months. Longer-term treatment for relapse prevention should be considered in those people who've had recurrent depression. But what's really important is that, as I've said, we should be reviewing people on antidepressants and not leaving them on for years and years without review, without discussion about whether a psychological therapy might be helpful, without thinking about social prescribing, without reviewing whether the antidepressant is really necessary. And then just to reiterate again, we need to consider as GPs safe prescribing and avoidance of tricyclics. I really can't say that enough. And I suppose one of the things that has occurred to me with the new primary care networks and primary care pharmacists is maybe this is a role for the pharmacist to look at prescribing for older adults, particularly around antidepressants, and to highlight where there's unsafe prescribing.
So that's certainly a sort of a quality improvement area that we can think about.
Yeah, and maybe people would want to think about doing an audit of their older adults on antidepressants, and they may be surprised about the length of time that we leave older adults on antidepressants.
Very good idea, yes. Do you think, though, that sort of one way of treating is better than the other? You know, do we just use medication or do we use other things together?
The evidence is that more than one approach is needed. So we should be offering referral to IAPT, social prescribing, follow-up by the GP, and in moderate to severe depression, then antidepressants are indicated, but they shouldn't be seen as a solution. NICE guidance suggests that a collaborative care framework is useful, and it's certainly evidence-based for older adults with depression, particularly if they've got significant physical health or social health problems. And in this model of care, a case manager will deliver a psychosocial intervention perhaps monitor medication, signpost to other services, so fitting the role of the social prescriber, but also having close supervision from specialist care and liaison with the GP to monitor the patient's progress.
And just as a slightly different sort of area, I'm aware that it can be sometimes quite difficult to diagnose depression when the patient has dementia, so or it's difficult to separate the two out. Have you got any advice that you could give the clinicians about this?
Yes, I think there's two time points when this is difficult. So a person can present with some apparent cognitive impairment, but also symptoms of depression. And as a GP, I don't know if this is the beginnings of dementia or if this is a depressive illness. And I think pragmatically, you can give a trial of an antidepressant, schedule in a review, preferably with caregivers so that you can get a collateral history. And then if there's been no improvement or if there's been an improvement in mood, but actually the memory impairment becomes more obvious, then a referral to specialist services are required. There's also older adults who have dementia get depressed, and I think this is quite frequently missed in general practice. It's difficult to diagnose. Caregivers may notice a change in mood or a change in behaviour. I think in nursing homes we miss it because the person who's sitting in the corner who's very quiet might actually be depressed, and sometimes that takes a specialist to come in and do a proper assessment, because an antidepressant can help the mood of somebody who's got dementia.
So from all of the things you said, it seems to me that as GPs, we're really in quite a unique position to support older people with mental health problems, particularly if we're likely to see them in surgery fairly regularly for their physical health problems. Having sort of gone through all the information that we've discussed, is there any other resource or resources that you can think of that would be useful for GPs and other frontline staff to have a look at?
Yeah, so the Royal College of General Practitioners website has the Mental Health Toolkit, and there's lots of nice resources on there. There's also the Practice Primer for Mental Health, which is a great resource for GPs and other primary care professionals, and it looks at the wide range of common mental health problems that we see in older adults in primary care.
And is there anything that we could suggest that you know of for the patients and their family?
Yeah, so the Royal College of Psychiatrists has got an excellent website with a number of resources for patients, caregivers, but they're also useful for practitioners. And Age UK, again, has got some information. Similarly, some of the other mental health charities, such as Mind, have got information about depression and mental health problems in older.
Brilliant, thank you. So I'm going to summarise some takeaway messages just to finish off. And for me, it seems that recognising and diagnosing self-harm and mental health problems probably needs a different approach to that used for working age adults. And it seems to me that this narrative, this talking and communication, we need to take a biopsychosocial approach, which allows us to detect mental health problems in people with physical symptoms. And I think, as you mentioned, we should be referring older adults to psychological therapy much more, rather relying on medication, just medication. I think we need to make sure we're aware of the risk factors for self-harm and suicide. So we know depression is a key risk factor, but also if somebody has a previous history of self-harm, comorbid physical health conditions, and polypharmacy, particularly because overdose of drugs is one of the main methods of self-harm in older people. And again, there's a role around reviewing medication, thinking about less toxic medication for both the mental health aspect and pain management.
Yeah, so I'd just like to reiterate that. It's really important to review older adults following self-harm particularly reviewing medication, and that we should be referring to specialist services following self-harm because the chances of a completed suicide is higher in an older adult. So thinking about, do we need to refer this? Do we have a good relationship with our older psychiatrist?
Thanks ever so much, Carolyn. I think it's been a really interesting discussion and for highlighting the role that GPs and frontline practitioners have in identifying and managing self-harm in older adults, which ultimately will contribute to a reduction in suicide.
Thanks. I was going to say it's been a good talk.
Yeah, it's been great. And just say that all of the resources we have mentioned, so the practice primer and the website links, we're going to put them onto the website, the RCGP Mental Health Toolkit, so that will be available as well for people to have a look at and avail themselves of those. So thank you.
Thank you.